Christ, there's a boat dead ahead. The steep swells had hidden it up to that moment, but now she bobbed up on a crest. It was a tiny trawler, flying a dirty scrap of canvas as a staysail at her stubby mast and struggling piteously in the granite jaws of thunderbolt and suicide. Wild goose! Roared Sergio, and he reached for the handle of the foghorn that hung above his head. Now we have some fun! And he yanked the handle. The croaking bellow of the foghorn echoed off the cliffs that were closing on either side of them. Kill my boys, eh? Shoot me, eh? Trick me, eh? Now I trick you, but good. Sergio punctuated his triumphant yells with blasts on the foghorn. Christ, no, you can't do it, Johnny caught urgently at the big Italian's shoulder. But Sergio struck his hand away and steered directly for the trawler as it lay full in the narrow passage. I give him plenty warning, Sergio sent another blast echoing off the cliffs. He no give me warning when he shoot me, de bastard. There was a group of men on the trawler's foredeck. Johnny could see that they were manhandling an inflatable escape raft, a thick mattress of black rubber, towards the nearest side of the trawler. But now they were frozen by the bellow of Kingfisher's foghorn. They stood looking up at the tall cliff of steel that bore down on them. Their faces were pale blobs in the gloom. Sergio, it's murder! Turn away, damn you! You can miss them! Turn away! Again, Johnny lunged across the wheelhouse and grabbed at the wheel. Sergio swung a backhanded blow that cracked against Johnny's temple and sent him reeling back, half-stunned against the storm doors. Who a captain for this bloody ship? There was blood on Sergio's lips. The shout had torn something inside him. Kingfisher's bows were lifting and swinging down like an executioner's axe over the trawler. They were close enough now for Johnny to recognize the men on the trawler's deck, but only one of them held his full attention. Benedict van der Bael cowered against the trawler's rail, gripping it with both hands. His hair fluttered soft and dark in the wind. His eyes were big dark holes like those of a skull in the bone-white face, and his lips a pink circle of terror. Then suddenly the trawler disappeared under Kingfisher's massive bows, and immediately after that came the splintering, crunching sound of her timbers shattering. Kingfisher bore on down the passage between the cliffs without a check in her speed. Johnny fumbled with the catch of the storm doors, and the wind tore it open. He staggered out to the exposed wing of the bridge and reached the rail. He stood there with the storm clawing at his clothing and looking down at the wreckage that dragged slowly along Kingfisher's hull, and then was left behind. There were human heads bobbing among the wreckage, and the wash from Kingfisher's propeller pushed them towards the cliffs of suicide. A wave picked up one of the men and carried him swiftly onto the cliff, sweeping him high and then swirling back to leave the body stranded on that smooth white slope of granite. The man was still alive. Johnny saw him clawing at the smooth rock with his bare fingers, trying to drag himself above the reach of the sea. It was Hugo Kramer. Even through the fog of spray, there was no mistaking that head of pale hair and the lithe, twisted body. The next wave reached up and dragged him back over the rock, tearing the nails from his hooked fingers as he tried to find a hold. He was swirled and flung about in the turbulence below the cliff before another wave lifted him and hurled him out onto the granite. One of his legs was broken at the knee by the force of the impact, and the lower part of the leg spun loosely like the blade of a windmill as the water tugged at it. Once again Hugo was left stranded, but now he made no movement. His arms were flung wide, and his legs stuck out at a grossly unnatural angle from the knee. Then from among these mighty waves there rose up a mass of green water which dwarfed all the others. It reared up with slow majesty and hung poised over the granite cliff before it fell on Hugo's broken body with a boom that seemed to shake the very rock. When the giant wave drew back, the cliff was washed clean. Hugo was gone. The same wave that destroyed him came down the passage between the cliffs, and in contrast to its treatment of Hugo Kramer, it was tender as a mother as it lifted Kingfisher and carried her out into the open sea beyond the reach of those cruel cliffs. Looking back into the gap between the islands, the last trace that Johnny saw of the wild goose was the black rubber escape raft tossing and leaping high on the turmoil of broken water and creamy spindrift. "They'll have no use for that," he said aloud. He searched for a sight of any survivor, but there was none. They were chewed to pulp in the jaws of thunderbolt and suicide, and swallowed down into the cold green maw of the sea. Johnny turned away and went back into the wheelhouse. He lifted Tracy from the deck and carried her through to Sergio's cabin. As he laid her on the bunk, he whispered to her, "I'm glad. I'm glad you didn't see it, my darling." At midnight, the wind still howled about the ship, hurling sheets of solid rain against the windows of the bridge. 40 minutes later, the wind had veered through 180 degrees and become a light southeasterly air. The black sky opened like a theatre curtain, and the full moonlight burst through so brightly as to pale the stars. Though the tall black swell still marched in martial ranks from the north, the gentle wind was soothing and lulling them. "Sergio, you must rest now. I'll take the con. Let Tracy dress your back."
"You take the con," Sergio snorted scornfully. "I saved the ship, and you sink her for me. Not bloody likely."
"Listen, Sergio, we don't know how badly you're hurt. You're killing yourself." The same argument spluttered and flared intermittently during the long night hours, while Sergio clung stubbornly to the helm and coaxed the labouring vessel back towards Cartridge Bay. He insisted on detouring far out to sea to avoid the islands, so that when the bright dawn broke, the land was only a low brown line on the horizon, and the mountains of the interior were a distant blue. An hour after dawn, Johnny made radio contact with the very agitated operator at Cartridge Bay.
"Mr. Lance, we've been trying to raise you since yesterday evening."
"I've been busy." Despite his fatigue, Johnny grinned at his own understatement. "Now listen to me. We're coming into Cartridge Bay. We'll be there in a couple of hours. I want you to have a doctor, Dr. Robin Sutherland, flown up from Cape Town. Also, I want you to have the police standing by. I want somebody from both the Diamond Police and the Robbery and Murder Squad. Have you got that?"
The police are here already, Mr. Lance. They're looking for Mr. Benedict van der Bale. They found his car here. They have a warrant."
The operator's voice broke off, and Johnny heard the mumble of background voices. Then,
Mr. Lance, are you there? Stand by to speak to Inspector Stander of the CID.
"Negative," Johnny cut in on his transmission.
"I'm not talking to anybody. He can wait until we get into the bay. Just you have Dr. Sutherland ready. I've got a badly wounded man on board."
Johnny leaned over the radio set and shut off the main switch. Then he stood and made his way slowly back to the bridge. Every muscle in his body felt stiff and bruised, and he was groggy with tiredness. But he took up the argument with Sergio when they had left off.
"Now listen to me, Sergio, you must lie down. You can take us in over the bar, but now you must get an hour or two's rest."
Still, Sergio would not relinquish the wheel, but he consented to strip to the waist and let Tracy examine his back. In the expanse of white muscle were little black holes, each set in its own purple bruise. Some of the holes had sealed themselves with black clotted blood. From others, fluid still oozed, clear or pink in colour, and there was a faint sweetish smell from the wounds. Johnny and Tracy exchanged worried looks before Tracy reached into the first aid box and set to work.
"How she look, Johnny?"
Sergio's jovial tone was belied by his face, which was a lump of bread dough touched with greenish-blue hues.
"It depends if you like your meat rare,"
Johnny matched his tone, and Sergio chuckled, but cut it short with a wince. Johnny put a cheroot between Sergio's lips and held a match for him. As Sergio puffed the tip into a glow, Johnny asked casually,
"What made you change your mind?"
And Sergio looked up at him quickly, guiltily, through the cloud of cheroot smoke.
"You had us cold. You could have got away with it."
"Perhaps," Johnny persisted quietly.
"What made you come back?"
"Listen, Johnny, me, I'd done some damn awful bloody things, but I never, never killed a man or a woman, ever. He say no killing. Fine, I go along. Then I hear the plastique blow. I know you two in conveyor room. I think the hell with it. Now I climb off the wagon. But she going too fast. I get bum full of buckshot."
They were silent for a while. Tracy was absorbed in patching the shot wounds with adhesive tape. Johnny broke the silence.
Was there a big diamond, Sergio? A big blue diamond?
Eh, si, Sergio sighed. It's such a diamond you will never see again.
Benedict had it?
Eh, si. Benedict had it.
Did he have it on him?
Eh, si. In his coat pocket. He put it in his coat pocket. Tracy stepped back.
That's all we can do for you now, she murmured and caught Johnny's eye, shaking her head slightly and frowning with worry. The sooner we get him to a doctor, the happier I'll be.
A little before noon, Sergio took Kingfisher in through the entrance to Cartridge Bay, handling the mud-filled ship with all the aplomb of the master mariner. But as they approached the first turning in the channel, he sagged gently to the deck, and the wheel spun out of his hands. Before Johnny could reach the helm, Kingfisher had yawed warily across the channel. She had so little way on her that when she went up on the sandbank, there was only a small jolt, and she listed over a few degrees. Johnny pulled the engine telegraph to stop.
"Help me, Tracy."
He stooped over Sergio and took him under the armpits. Tracy grasped his ankles. Half dragging, half carrying, they got him through to his cabin and laid him on his bunk.
"Hey, Johnny. Sorry, Johnny,"
Sergio was mumbling.
"The first time I put the ship on the bank, ever. Idiot. So close, then, whap. Sorry, hey, Johnny."
The motor launch left the jetty and came down the channel towards the sandbank on which Kingfisher lay stranded. The launch was crowded, and the whine of the outboard engine raised a storm of waterfowl into a whirlwind of frightened wings. As it drew closer, Johnny recognized some of the occupants. Mike Shapiro, and with him Robin Sutherland. But there were also two uniformed policemen and another person in civilian clothes who stood up in the launch as it came within hail and cupped his hands about his mouth.
"I'm a police officer. I have a warrant for the arrest of Benedict."
Mike Shapiro touched the man's arm and spoke softly to him. The officer hesitated and glanced up at Johnny again, before nodding agreement and settling back onto his seat.
"Robin, get up here as quick as you can," Johnny shouted down at the launch.
And when Robin came over the side, Johnny hustled him towards the bridge, but Mike Shapiro hurried after them.
"Johnny, I must talk to you." "It can wait."
"No, it can't." Mike Shapiro turned to Tracy.
"Won't you take care of the doctor, please? I must speak to Johnny before the police do."
Mike led Johnny down the deck and offered him a cigarette while the three policemen hovered at a discreet distance.
"Johnny, I've some dreadful news. I want to break it to you myself."
Johnny visibly braced himself.
"Yes?"
"It's about Ruby."
Johnny made his statement to the police inspector in Kingfisher's guest cabin. It took 2 hours for him to relate the full story, and during that time one of the uniformed policemen discovered the crew locked in the paint store below decks. They were half poisoned with paint fumes, but able to make their statements to the police. The inspector kept them waiting in the next door cabin while he finished his interrogation of Johnny.
Two more questions for now, Mr. Lance. In your opinion, was the collision between the two ships accidental or deliberate?
Johnny looked into the steel-grey eyes and lied for the first time.
"It was unavoidable."
The inspector nodded and made a note on his pad.
"Last questions, the survivors from the trawler, what were their chances?"
"In that storm they had none. There was no hope of effecting a rescue with Kingfisher almost disabled, and considering the condition of the surf in the passage between the islands."
"I understand,"
the inspector nodded. "Thank you, Mr. Lance. That's all for the present." Johnny left the cabin and went quickly to the upper deck. Tracy and Robin were still working over Sergio's bunk, but Robin looked up and came immediately to Johnny as he stood in the doorway.
"How is he, Robin?"
"He hasn't a chance," Robin replied, keeping his voice low. "One lung has collapsed, and there appear to be perforations of the bowel and intestine. I suspect a massive peritonitis. I can't move him without risking a secondary hemorrhage."
"Is he conscious?"
Robin shook his head.
"He's going fast. God knows how he lasted this long."
Johnny moved across to the bunk and placed his arm about Tracy's shoulders. She moved closer to him, and they stood looking down at Sergio. His eyes were closed, and a dark pelt of new beard covered the lower part of his face. His breathing soared and hissed loudly in the quiet cabin, and the fever lit bright spots of colour in his cheeks.
"You magnificent old rogue," Johnny spoke softly, and Sergio's eyes blinked open. Quickly, Johnny stooped to him. "Sergio, your crew, your boys are safe."
Sergio smiled. He closed those dark gazelle eyes, then opened them again and whispered painfully,
"Hey, Johnny, will you give me a job when I come out of the prison?"
"They won't have you in prison. You would lower the tone of the place." Sergio tried to laugh. He managed one strangled chuckle. Then he came up on his elbows in the bunk with his eyes bulging, his mouth gaping for breath. He coughed once, a harsh, tearing sound, and the blood burst from his lips in thick black clots and a bright red spray of droplets. He fell back on the pillows and was dead before Robin reached his side. Tracy was asleep in the bedroom next door. Robin had sedated her heavily enough to keep her that way for the next 12 hours. Johnny lay naked on the narrow bunk in the second guest room of the Cartridge Bay Depot. And when he switched on the bedside lamp, his wristwatch showed the time as 2:46 in the morning. He looked down at his own body. The bruises were dark purple and hot, angry red across his ribs and flanks, from where the mud had battered him against rough steel plating. He wished now that he had accepted sleeping pills that had been offered him, for the ache of his body and the whirl of his thoughts had kept him from sleep all that night. His mind was trapped on a nightmare roundabout, revolving endlessly the two deaths which Benedict van der Bael must answer for in the dark places to which he had surely gone. Ruby and Sergio. Ruby and Sergio. One he had seen die, the other he could imagine in all its gruesome detail. Johnny sat up and lit a cigarette, seeking a distraction from the tortured images with which his over-excited brain bombarded him. He tried to concentrate on reviewing the practical steps that would be necessary to clear up the aftermath of these last disastrous days. He had spoken that evening by radio to Larson and received from him a promise of complete financial support during the time it would take to clear the mud from Kingfisher's hull and recover the diamonds in the conveyor tunnel, and to tide over the period of salvage and repair before the dredger was ready to begin once more harvesting the rich fields of Thunderbolt and Suicide. A salvage team would fly in tomorrow to begin the work on Kingfisher. He had cabled IBM requesting engineers to check out the computer for water damage. 6 weeks, Johnny estimated, before Kingfisher was ready for sea. Then his unruly imagination leapt suddenly ahead to Ruby's funeral. It was set for Tuesday next week. Johnny rolled restlessly on his bunk, trying to shut his mind against the thoughts that assaulted it. But they crowded forward in a dark host. Ruby, Benedict, Sergio, the big blue diamond. He sat up again, stubbed out his cigarette, and reached across to switch out the bedside lamp. He froze like that, as a new thought pressed in on him. He heard Sergio's voice in his memory. "Is such a diamond as you will never see again." Now he felt the idea come ghosting along his spine so that the hair at the nape of his neck and on his forearms prickled with excitement. "The red gods!" he exclaimed, almost shouting the name, and again Sergio's voice spoke. "In his coat. He put it in his coat a pocket." Johnny swung his legs off the bunk and reached for his clothes. He felt the pounding of his heart beneath his fingers as he buttoned his shirt. He pulled on slacks and sweater, tied the laces of his shoes, and snatched up a sheepskin jacket as he ran from the room. He was shrugging on the jacket as he entered the deserted radio room and switched on the lights. He crossed quickly to the chart table and pored over it. He found the name on the map and repeated it aloud. The Red Gods. North of Cartridge Bay, the coast ran straight and featureless for 30 miles. Then, abruptly, the line of it was broken by the outthrust of red rock, poking into the sea like an accuser's finger. Johnny knew it well. It was his job to find and examine any such natural feature that might act as a barrier to the prevailing inshore currents. At such a place, diamonds and other seaborne objects would be thrown ashore. He remembered the red rock cliffs carved by wind and sea into the grotesque natural statues which gave the place its name. But more important, he remembered the litter of ocean debris on the beaches beneath the cliff, driftwood, waterlogged planking, empty bottles, plastic containers, scraps of nylon fishing net and corks, all of it cast overboard and carried up by the current to be deposited on this promontory. He ran his finger down the chart and held it on the dots of Thunderbolt and Suicide. He read the laconic notation over the tiny arrows that flew from the islands towards the stark outline of the Red Gods. Current sets south-southwest 5 knots. Above the chart table, the depot keys hung on their little cup hooks, each labelled and numbered. Johnny selected the two of them marked Garage and Land Rover. The moon was full and high. The night was still and without a trace of wind. Johnny swung the double doors of the garage open and switched on the parking lights of the Land Rover. By their glow, he checked out the vehicle. Petrol tank full, the spare 5-gallon cans in their brackets full, the can of drinking water full. He dipped his finger into the neck of the water container and tasted it. It was clean and sweet. He lifted the passenger seat and checked the compartment beneath it. Jack and tire spanner, first aid kit, flashlight, signal rockets and smoke flares, water bottle, canvas ground sheet, 2 cans of survival rations, tow rope, toolkit, knapsack, knife and compass. The Land Rover was equipped to meet any of the emergencies of desert travel. Johnny climbed behind the wheel and started the engine. He drove quietly and slowly past the depot buildings, not wanting to awaken those sleeping inside, but when he hit the firm sand at the edge of the lagoon, he switched on the headlights and gunned the engine. He cut across the sand dunes at the entrance to the bay and swung northwards onto the beach. The headlights threw solid white beams into the sea mist, and startled seabirds rose on flapping ghost wings before the rush of the Land Rover. The tide was out, and the exposed beach was hard and shiny wet, smooth as a tarmac road. He drove fast, and the white beach crabs were blinded by the headlights and crunched crisply beneath the tyres. The dawn came early, silhouetting the mystic shapes of the dunes against the red sky. Once he startled a strand wolf, one of the brown hyenas which scavenged this bleak littoral. It galloped, hunch-shouldered, in hideous panic for the safety of the dunes. Even in his urgency, Johnny felt a stir of revulsion for the loathsome creature. The cold, damp rush of the wind into his face refreshed Johnny. It cooled the gritty feeling of his eyes and eased the throb of sleeplessness in his temples. The sun burst over the horizon and lit the red gods 5 miles ahead with all the drama of stage lighting. They glowed golden red in the dawn, a procession of huge, half-human shapes that marched into the sea. As Johnny drove towards them, the light and shadow played over the cliffs, and he saw a 100-foot-tall figure of Neptune stooping to dip his flowing red beard into the sea, while a monstrous hunchback with the head of a wolf pranced beside him. Ranks of Vestal virgins in long robes of red rock jostled with the throng of weird and fantastic shapes. It was eerie and disquieting. Johnny curbed his fancy and turned his attention to the beaches at the foot of the cliffs. What he saw started his skin tingling again, and he pressed the accelerator flat against the floorboards. Racing across the wet sand to where a white cloud of seabirds circled and dived and hopped about, something lay on the water's edge. As he drove towards them, a gull flew across the front of the Land Rover. A long ribbon of something wet and fleshy dangled from its beak, and the gull gulped at it greedily in flight. Its crop was distended and engorged with food. The seabirds scattered raucously and indignantly as the Land Rover approached, leaving a human body lying in the centre of an area of sand that was dappled by the prints of their webbed feet and fouled with dropped feathers and excreta. Johnny braked the Land Rover and jumped out. He took one long look at the body, then turned quickly away and braced himself against the side of the vehicle. His gorge rose in a hot flood of nausea, and he gagged it back. The body was nude, but for a few sodden tatters of clothing and a sea boot still laced onto one foot. The birds had attacked every inch of exposed flesh, except for the scalp. The face was unrecognizable. The nose was gone, the eye sockets were empty black holes. There were no lips to cover the grinning teeth. Above this ruined face, the shock of colourless albino hair looked like a wig placed there as an obscene and tasteless joke. Hugo Kramer had made the long voyage from Thunderbolt and Suicide to the Red Gods. Johnny took the canvas ground sheet from under the passenger seat of the Land Rover. Averting his eyes from the task, he wrapped the corpse carefully, tied the whole bundle with lengths of rope cut from the tow line, then laboriously dragged it up the beach well above the high water mark. The thick canvas would keep off the birds, but to make doubly certain, Johnny collected the driftwood and planking that was scattered thickly along the high water line and piled it over the corpse. Some of the planking was freshly broken, and the paint on it was still bright and new. Johnny guessed this was part of the wreckage of Wild Goose. He went back to the Land Rover and drove on towards the Red Gods, which lay only a mile ahead. The sun was well up by now, and already its heat was uncomfortable. As he drove, he struggled out of the sheepskin jacket without interrupting his search of the beach ahead. He was looking for another gathering of seagulls, but instead he saw a large black object stranded in the angle formed by the red stone cliffs. He was 50 yards from it before he realized what it was. He felt his stomach jar violently and then clench at the shock. It was a black rubber inflatable life raft, and it had been dragged up the beach above the high water line. As he climbed out of the Land Rover, Johnny felt his legs trembling beneath him, as though he had just climbed a mountain. The hard, knotted sensation in his chest shortened his breathing. He went slowly towards the raft, and there was a story to read in the soft sand. The smooth drag marks of the raft, and the two sets of footprints, one set made by bare feet, broad, stubby-toed, and with flattened arches, the prints of a man who habitually went barefoot. These tracks had been made by one of the coloured crew of Wild Goose, Johnny decided, dismissed them, and turned his whole attention to the other set of footprints. Shod feet, long and narrow, smooth leather soles, the imprints were sharp-edged, suggesting new shoes, little worn. The length of the stride and the depth of the prints were those of a tall, heavily built man. Johnny realized with mild surprise that his hands were shaking now, and even his lips quivered. He was like a man in high fever, light-headed, weak and shaking. It was Benedict van der Bael. He knew it with complete and utter certainty. Benedict had survived the maelstrom of Thunderbolt and Suicide. Johnny balled his fists, squeezing hard, and he thrust out his jaw, tightening his lips. Still the hatred washed over his mind in dark, hot waves. "Thank God," he whispered. "Thank God, now I can kill him myself."